Welcome. I introduce Dr. L. Mahadevan, who studied engineering at the Indian Institute of Technology in Chennai before turning to applied mathematics and mechanics at Stanford University, where he obtained his PhD. He's currently the Lola England Developine Professor of Applied Mathematics at Harvard. He's the recipient of numerous awards that include the Society of Engineering Science Young Investigator Medal and a Guggenheim Fellowship. However, what characterizes Dr. Mahadevan's work is an almost Zen-like ability to see the extraordinary in the ordinary. His mantra is, familiarity does not mean comprehension, and is known for studying natural phenomena that most people take for granted. He has studied the patterns made by crumpled paper, the way fabrics fold, how a flag flutters in the breeze, and the lightning-quick reflexes of the Venus flytrap. With a combination of scientific rigor and childlike curiosity, he takes very seriously the questions of a six-year-old child and then answers them in the peer-reviewed papers of Nature, Science, and PNAS. He talks today of mathematics, mechanics, and motility. I present to you Dr. Mahadevan.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sana. Can people hear me at the back? Okay, maybe now. Yes? There's a delay. Okay, so it's an honor and a pleasure to be here. I've been here for a day, and I enjoy talking to a lot of people that I would not normally meet. And I want to tell you about some of the things, in fact, that Zubin already introduced me with. Questions associated with biology, but at the intersection not just of biology, different subdivisions of biology, but at the intersection of biology, physics, and mathematics. And I chose to actually talk today about movement because in some sense, when we are children, we assume that movement is a signature of life, one way. That is, if something is living, it can move. Plants typically don't, although I will give you exception. You know what exceptions to that rule, and I'll tell you something about it in a few minutes. Of course, movement does not imply life. And the way I want to introduce this is, rather than being talking about one specific system, I thought I'll give you a small vignette of different kinds of systems that we've looked at different length and different time scales, because that's the way I think as an applied mathematician, and try and understand how, by looking at specific examples, perhaps we can actually understand some of the general principles associated with motility. And because we're trying to be quantitative, we want to try and start simple, and perhaps sometimes the questions that we ask may be too simple, but I hope I'll be able to persuade you that even if they are too simple, you still can learn by essentially comparison. In order to do that, I wanted to introduce a few examples of movement. So I want to start by giving you some examples of motility, tell you about what the mechanical and the physical issues are. And even though I'm not going to really have a whole lot of time to get into the mathematical details, I'll give you some inkling of what goes into these mathematical models that essentially allow us to understand motility. And when we think about motility or locomotion, we can essentially think about it at different scales. We can think about it at the level of an individual molecule, and there have been some spectacular advances over the last 20 to 25 years all over the world in trying to understand the molecular basis of motility. But in fact, all the examples that I'm going to give you are at the level above the molecule. So you have a large number of molecules which essentially can be assembled together to give rise to unusual kinds of motility. And the reason that I think I'd like to convince you it's worthwhile to study unusual examples of motility is because some particular aspect of motility has been amplified above all. And as a consequence, by studying that particular example, you can actually maybe hope to learn something which you wouldn't see if I had an individual subunit or a single molecule. Okay? So the first example over here, which I'll spend actually a fair bit of time, but right now I just introduce the example, is essentially the sperm of a crab, a horseshoe crab, which is actually neither horseshoe-shaped nor a crab, so I'm not quite sure why it has the terminology that it does. But it's actually found on the East Coast, and in springtime they come onshore in masses. It's prehistoric, a few hundred million years old, and they spawn. And the sperm of the horseshoe crab, which is a few microns in size, has a tail, And out of its front end comes, in fact, a harpoon-like object, which I'll introduce, as I said, in great detail later on, which penetrates the egg and starts the process of fertilization. It's a very, very simple engine. It has to happen only once. The scale over which this happens is 60 microns. The size of the sperm itself is a few microns. And there are some mathematical questions that arise immediately. Question one, how do I essentially pack this macroscopic object inside a volume which is so small and then unpack it? In fact, that question, of course, arises all the time when we think about the genome, when we think about DNA and how it has to be packed and unpacked inside a nucleus. Here is a much simpler version of that. And I'll claim that this is essentially a spring. I'll show you evidence for that later on. It's acting like a very simple spring, which therefore should be amenable to analysis and careful quantitative experimentation. If I move to essentially the same scale, but to now slightly more complicated movements, here, in fact, is a movie taken by Charlie Brooker maybe 25, 30 years ago of a sperm which has a flagellum, but now the flagellum is essentially oscillating rather than having a linear movement which essentially lasts for a few seconds. And this is, by the way, in real time, so is this. This movement is essentially oscillatory and can go on as long as there is fuel. Okay. So now I basically have to ask, how do I convert maybe rectilinear motion or oscillatory motion on the scale of a molecule to macroscopic oscillations on a large scale? Okay, so again, there is a question mathematically of scaling up. There's a question mathematically of asking how I move from a description at the single molecule level of what happens at the collective level. And then, of course, you can start asking questions about once I understand how it oscillates, what determines its speed, what determines its direction, so on and so forth. So here are springs, here are motors, and in fact, there is a third way, which has actually been extremely popular to study from a biophysical perspective over the last decade or so, which is just by growth. If I have a molecule and I add a number of these, one after the other, then in fact size increases. But if I basically have a block at the back, then size increase is prevented in one direction and can only occur in another direction. And so I can use that to do work. So I can get polymerization or shrinkage, if I can attach something to the end, to do work. And here is an image, essentially. I wish I had a movie. I don't. Of bacteria. Shown in these as red dots, using actin polymerization to drive themselves as a battleship might through the ocean, except this is inside a cell. Okay? So these are examples of motility at the small scale, at the level of a few microns. Okay? All these occur inside a cell or at the level of a cell. If I go up in scale, you can think about now whole organism movement. And in fact, over here is a movie of a worm, C. elegans, in fact, crawling on agar. And again, you can ask the same question that I asked over here. What are the mechanisms associated with motility? What determines the gait? How does the gait change as a function of the environment? How does it change as a function of stimulus? How, if I knew both these, can I actually say something about, for example, how the worm navigates in the presence of food or runs away from something which is toxic? And over there, now we're thinking not about individual motors or even individual assemblies of motors, but we're thinking about very large collective scale phenomena, for example, associated with muscles. Now, these are movements associated with animals or inside animals, and I'm going to actually spend a third, I hope, of the talk telling you about plants and how they can actually do something just as spectacular, such as catching a fly. This is the Venus fly trap. And a single or two leaves of this can essentially close rapidly enough. Again, this isn't real time, to essentially catch a fly. And this is occurring on an even larger scale. And I will show you evidence that, in fact, this is just movement driven by water, but moving water in extremely clever ways. Okay? So these examples of motility can be parsed at different levels, as I actually showed you through the examples. But now, actually, let me run you through a quick list. First, you can ask questions at the molecular level, at the level of a single molecule, a nanometer or so. I told you about how you can essentially get motion by addition or removal of material. I told you how you can get motion by change of conformation once, such as in a switch. That could, for example, drive something like the spring that I showed you. Or I could have conformation change, which is cyclic, because I have the addition and the throwaway of a molecule, such as an NTP. Okay? And then I have continuous consumption, rather than when I have stored energy, which I'm essentially using to drive the system just once. And that's the level of a molecule. I have a rough classification in terms of these three. I mean, this conformation change, of course, can also be driven by proton motor gradients, for example, as is well known in bacteria. What I want to tell you about is at the next level, where I'm thinking about collective behavior, where I have a large number of these. And even over there, I can essentially take all these ideas at the level of an individual molecule and say I have The first one corresponds to polymerization engines. The second corresponds to spring engines, where I have a switch. The third corresponds to essentially muscular engines, where I have, for example, an NTPase-driven movement. And then something which doesn't have a real molecular counterpart, because it's truly collective, it doesn't really add up from the molecules. It only arises when I have a large number of them, which are hydraulic engines. And in each one of these, as I said, we want to think about making mathematical models of them and trying to connect to experiment. We need to know something about the shape and the structure. We need to know something about chemistry, how molecules change shape in response to addition or subtraction of other molecules, how, in fact, that shape change itself is mediated by forces in order to essentially give rise to mechanical work. Okay. And the macroscopic questions that one is asking, as I showed you in the case of the worm, is how do you select gait? What determines the wavelength of the worm? What determines the size of my stride? How does it change as a function of stimulus? If I know that, then I can say something about how to design things. If I was an engineer, then I can also ask questions about how one might imitate that. And if I was interested in behavior, one of the first things I have to understand if I start asking questions about behavior is, once I know, I have to know how things move in order to figure out how things will actually respond to the environment. So it's the first question that you will ask in almost any biological system to understand very high-level questions is to understand motility itself. I focused over here on length scales, varying from a nanometer to our size, in fact. But you can ask the same question associated with time scales as well. And I've just put down one number over here, because there is no limit to how slowly you can do things. But there is a limit, it turns out, in biology, at least biology on this planet, as to how fast you can do things on the scale of an organelle. And the fastest event that I know in microscopic biology is that associated with the jellyfish sting, which can essentially get its sting inside you in about 10 microseconds. And so you can ask what the limits are. What are the physical limits associated with that? What determines the velocity? What determines the power? And once I know the physical limits or the physical chemical limits, what actually does that mean for the physiological limits? Okay. I won't really answer that question, but I want to raise it over here. Of course, I'm thinking about motility. I have to think about energy. I'm just putting this up for the students over here, because we normally think of energy as being measured purely in terms of hydrolysis of NTP, unless I'm thinking about photosynthesis, for example, where I have solar energy. And just as a number that immediately puts out for you on the scale of nanometers a few piconewtons. And this is something that you see all the time showing up in single molecule studies, but that's really not what I want to focus on over here. Okay. So I want to dive in now to microscopic examples. And macroscopic examples. And so here's the outline of what I want to tell you about. I want to start by thinking about molecular machines, and I want to focus on these sort of out-of-the-way, extraordinary machines, which are just springs. I'll briefly mention something about arrays of motors in the context of flagella, but I won't get into any detail, but just to give you a flavor of the way we approach these problems. And then I want to spend the second half of the talk on organismal machines associated with two kinds of movements. One is moving through water, or could be on land, and the other one is moving using water. And if I have time, which I don't think I will, I want to tell you how, once we know these things, we can actually start to address questions associated with the integration at higher levels to understand behavior. All these are driven by experiments and very close collaborations with a number of experimental colleagues, some done in our lab, some done in collaboration with people at other universities, Paul Matsudaira at MIT, in my lab, Yoel Forter and Jacques Dumay. And in theory, we've had a number of students working with us, Adam Cohen, Christoph Riera, and Jan Skottheim. And I'll mention these names as we go along, tell you who did what. Okay, so on to the first one. If I want to think about a machine, I want to convert chemical potential, for example, to mechanical work, I have no choice but to think about then mechanochemistry. And I want to introduce this example because this was, in fact, one of the first instances of molecular motility observed, macromolecular motility observed, in fact, by the inventor of the microscope himself, Anton Leeuwenhoek, in 1676. And it's only now beginning to be understood. So what is the organism that he looked at? It's Vorticella, which is a pond weed, which is has a cell body, which is tens of microns in size, and a very long stalk with which, in fact, this Vorticella is attached to a rock or to a leaf. There are no motors known. Yet, this kind of motility associated with what you're seeing over here, a very rapid retraction of the cell body, occurs at centimeters a second, tens of centimeters a second. And here is, in fact, a movie taken in Japan by Asai and co-workers, where, in fact, at 10,000 frames a second, you can essentially see the cell body retract really, really quickly. I want to show you this movie because, in fact, the mechanism associated with it at the molecular level is fairly simple, yet there is a collective question which we are just beginning to actually get a handle on. And the mechanism is the following. Turns out that there is a protein, very aptly called spasmin, which essentially forms a network. And that spasmin network is, because it's negatively charged, you have individual spasmin molecules essentially trying to repel each other, which are counteracting the entropic tendency for the molecule to contract on itself. So as long as you have this negative charge, the molecule or the network remains stretched out. When calcium enters across the bilayer, across the surrounding membrane, the calcium neutralizes the charge, and as it neutralizes the charge, this thing starts to contract. And there is effectively a wave of calcium which precedes the wave of contraction, and the mechanism is extremely simple, okay, to say. In words, you basically have a transition between an ordered, straight, almost oriented filamentous structure to a disordered one, which is essentially driven by calcium. I don't want to say anything more about this, except that, in fact, over here, it turns out that the maximum velocity is not dependent and not determined by the rate at which the calcium binds. Instead, it's determined by the combination of how the calcium binds and the hydrodynamics, how this cell body and the stalk move through the fluid. And if you actually make a measurement, which we've done, you find that, in fact, the maximum power is limited, but the maximum force is not. The maximum force can be very, very large at very short times. So this is an example of a spring which has extremely simple chemistry, driving mechanics. You just have a charge neutralization. Here is a much more familiar one, and this movie should replay, but it doesn't. And this is an image taken from Gary Borisy's lab, actually a movie taken from Borisy's lab, where you see microtubules, which are essentially growing for some time and then shrinking. And as Mitchison and Kirshner told us about 25 years ago, in fact, when you look at single microtubules, what you find is it grows very, very slowly and shrinks very, very rapidly. So there's this strong asymmetry in the kinetics of polymerization and depolymerization. And over the last two decades, what people have asked a question about is, how is this possible? And you can basically ask it at the chemical level, you can ask it at the structural level, at the kinetic level, or you can essentially ask it collectively, how are both of these connected together? And I just wanted to indicate over here a microtubule during this process of depolymerization, which has been flash frozen and then looked at under an electron microscope. And what you find is, in fact, that the ends are essentially splayed like that of a banana when you actually peel it. And consistent with this, and consistent, in fact, with a whole bunch of other experiments, a model that one can propose, which is, in fact, something that we proposed recently, is that you can essentially have conformation change associated with the fact that this banana peel kind of structure is stabilized by lateral interactions between the protofilaments and thereby stores mechanical energy until thermal fluctuations or a nick somewhere essentially triggers a crack of a critical size, and once the crack of a critical size is essentially formed, the whole thing falls apart. So there's a very nice mechanical or mechanochemical picture which allows you to take this kind of structural information and make sense of the macroscopic observations on the scale now of microns or even larger, but based on evidence at the nanometer scale. Both these examples essentially are examples of very simple ways to generate motility, just using something which is a spring, but it has chemistry. So with these in mind, as examples, and I'll give you more as we go along, I want to spend about 10 minutes on this example that I first told you about, namely the sperm of the horseshoe crab. And the fertilization process, which is called the acrosomal reaction. Okay, so here is the horseshoe crab. As I said, doesn't really look like one or the other of its names. Interestingly to me, it always is homunculus-like because, in fact, the sperm seems to look exactly like the organism on 5, 6, 7 orders of magnitude different. So if I look at the sperm itself in some detail, this is work, in fact, that started in the 1980s by Lou Tilney, in fact, who was a pioneer in thinking about unusual kinds of motility, along with Desrosiers. If you look at the interior or if you look at the sperm in cross-section, you find that it's mostly nuclear material. And for our purposes, what really matters is that there is a bundle of actin sitting around the base of the nucleus, and part of it essentially protrudes through a channel in the nucleus. And in the presence of calcium, so calcium comes back again, in the presence of calcium in the environment, so this is the native state of the sperm, this bundle of actin, in fact, actually squirts out, as you can see over here, at velocities of the order of tens of microns per second, fairly fast. We know from electron microscopy, in fact, this is one of the best studied macromolecular crystals there is, there are no motors. We also know there is no ATP. We know the dimensions. We know the structure. So it's a few tens of nanometers in diameter, as I said, very, very long. And from biochemistry, we know that there are only three components. There is actin, which is the main molecule. There is a glue, which essentially holds the actin filaments together, which Lew Tilney calls screw-in, because essentially it's holding all these things together. And there is an actuator element, if you like, and that actuator element is actually calmodulin, which is very familiar to people over here, that binds to calcium. Okay. And the question that I want to ask, is, how does it work? I know the components. It's fairly simple, it seems. I don't have anything complicated going on. I just add calcium. How does it work? And so, like always, we want to start with structure. So here are different resolutions of, essentially, the structure of the bundle. The only thing that I want to point out is, first, you see it's very beautifully packed at the base of the nucleus, as I said. Second, you have three states of the bundle. This is the native state, where, in fact, it's the filaments are coiled relative to each other. When you have a reaction in the forward direction, you have what's called the true discharge. It moves to something which is straight. All the filaments are lined up. And sometimes you can essentially reverse the chirality. And when you reverse the chirality, in fact, you switch to a state where you've flipped the direction which the actin essentially uncoils. And instead of uncoiling from the leading, from the front end of the sperm, it uncoils from the back. This reaction is reversible. This reaction is irreversible. Once you go from here to here, it's irreversible. And the idea is, which was already proposed, in fact, in the 80s, is that this is just a spring which is essentially triggered by calcium. So how can we understand that? At the molecular level, in fact, you can see that the calmodulin has two conformations. In the absence of calcium, it's closed. It's a dimer. And in the presence of calcium, in fact, it opens up. So there's a very small amount of twist, which you can actually, maybe you can see if you're in the front rows. You can't probably see in the back. The filaments are twisted in one direction, and then when the reaction occurs, they untwist. The amount of twist is tiny. Macroscopically, it seems like it's tiny. It's a quarter of a degree. But at the molecular level, it's huge, because it's of the order of a quarter of a degree per subunit, and the subunit is only 5 nanometers in size. So you'd have the ability to build up an enormous strain. And as I was telling you earlier, the reason that we chose to study this is precisely because a very small conformation change through geometry gets amplified onto scales of tens of microns. And so by studying this particular thing, you can understand two things. One is how you store energy at the molecular scale, and two, how you actually, in a coordinated way, allow this energy to be released over the entire bundle. Okay, so that's the goal, that's the question. I have to first understand structure, and then I have to understand dynamics, and then I want to try and connect the two. Oh, and if you look at the filament, you find, the bundle, you find that it's not smoothly curved. In fact, let me just go back and show it to you again. You can actually see over here, you have a bunch of straight bits, and then they're separated by kinks. Exactly the same thing over here. You can actually see that. So that was already a puzzle. Why, in fact, do you have kinks? In fact, let me ask a more general question. If you look at fibrillar assemblies, not just associated with actin, but microtubules, amyloid fibers, and in the physical and the physical chemical world, you can think about fibers of anything you want, ropes, nanotubes already. And you can ask a very general question, of which this is a specific instance, which is, when I start to bind filaments together, what kinds of morphologies can I get? What was peculiar about what I just showed you, and therefore very interesting, was that there was a particular distance between kinks that was very, very well conserved. There were exactly 14 of these for every 360 turn, and the kinks were strongly localized. How can we understand that? So I want to give you a sense of a mathematical model without going into any detail. If I have fibers, if I have, say, now let me simplify things to a ridiculous extent, I just have two fibers. Okay. And these two fibers have the ability to flex, and they have the ability to interact with each other. Okay. And if I'm looking at length scales which are large compared to the monomers that make up these fibers, then I can ask what is the energetic penalty associated with flexing an individual fiber, and what is the energetic penalty of interaction between fibers. So I would have an intra-filament bending stiffness, a mechanical property which characterizes how soft or stiff the object is in bending, which is actually a combination of a material quantity, material parameter, and also the geometry. The thinner it is, the smaller the bending stiffness is. The thicker it is, the larger. And I have an interfilament adhesion energy, which is an energy per unit length. Okay? And I ask now, with these two parameters, and just in the planar problem, how might I explain what we see? Forget the equations that are there. The physics is very, very simple. It's geometrical. If I have two filaments which are growing perfectly straight, starting from a nucleus which was perpendicular to the filaments, then they'd be perfectly happy because all their cross links, the places where they can glue to each other, will be in register. But as soon as they grow from a curved nucleus, something interesting is going to happen, precisely because the filaments have finite thickness. The guys on the outside have to essentially go further compared to the guys on the inside, which means I have to stretch the guys on the outside and compress the guys on the inside if I want the crosslinks to be in register. Or if I don't want the crosslinks to be in register, then I certainly have to make do with the fact that they are slipping relative to each other. And that essentially is exactly what I can characterize in terms of what happens to an individual filament versus what happens to the interaction between filaments. And there are now two parameters which appear naturally. One is a ratio of these two quantities, which actually turns out to be a square of a length. And that length, in fact, is going to determine the size of the kink. And there is a second parameter, which is purely geometric, which is how thick the filament is compared to, or a monomer is, compared to how long it is. Because if the monomers are very long, then I can essentially not slip so much. Well, if the monomers are very short, I'll slip a lot. If the monomers are very fat, I'll slip a lot. If the monomers are very skinny, I won't slip a lot. Okay? And with these two parameters, a length scale which comes from here, and the ratio of length scales that essentially arises from the geometry of an individual filament, you can construct a theory where you penalize the interaction of flexure, and you separately penalize slippage. And for those of you who come from a more mathematical and physical background, in fact, this energy, if I replace space by time, is exactly the energy in a pendulum. And that then allows you to explain the structure of the kink. It allows you to explain quantitatively now, all with measured quantities. Electron microscopy gives us the geometry. The adhesion energy is one thing, actually, we don't know, but we can infer from this, from one experiment, and use it somewhere else. And the bending stiffness, which has been measured. And we can quantitatively see where kinks come. That's the two-dimensional problem. And in three dimensions, it turns out, instead of getting planar kinks, I get helices, but these helices are faceted. And again, this is well-known, well-observed in many, many different systems, as I told you. You can see these planar kinks in nanotubes. Here you see these amyloid fibers of insulin, where as I increase the number of filaments, you see a transition in the morphology. And you can explain this quantitatively just using these two ingredients, and one more, which is the energy associated with twist. And in fact, those of you who've looked at textbooks on cell motility, one of the classics is Dennis Bray's book on cell movements, and on the cover, in fact, is an axostyle, an array of microtubules, and if you look at the microtubules in the inside, in fact, they are smoothly packed relative to each other. As you start to move outside, you can start to see that they are faceted. And the reason is exactly the same, because they have a larger length to cover, and if adhesion is strong, in fact, you'll start to see faceting. So here is a very simple example of thinking about the problem at the level above molecules, which actually allows you to make a little bit of progress, not only in the specific instance that I told you about in the context of the kinks in the acrosome, but also now outcomes, a slightly more general idea. But that's still, as I said, it's a digression. I want to come back to the problem. And then I want to digress again, and that's going to be what I'm going to do again and again. The kinks, even though they're there, are not relevant. How do we know that? We see experiments where, in fact, the acrosome comes out, the actin bundle comes out, but still remains kinked. That's great. So I understand where the kinks are and why they arise. They don't play any dynamical role, but I raised the question earlier about packing. And the kinks are very important because you can have a long filament. And you know very well that I can actually coil up a long filament and essentially pack it into a small volume. And what the kinks are doing is allowing you to convert twist to extension and vice versa. Okay? So the kinks have a deep geometrical significance, but have no dynamical significance at all. They arise because of the interaction between filaments and allow then, as in fact the bundle is being made, and we don't know the process, so I'm guessing here, as the bundle is being made, it allows it to essentially be in its packed form and allows the conversion of twist to extension. If I look at dynamics now, here is the extension as a function of time at two extreme temperatures. And what's very, very interesting is that, in fact, the extension is linear in time, so it's constant velocity. And again, this should be a puzzle, because if calcium was essentially binding, and if calcium was binding everywhere, you'd expect the velocity to initially shoot up and then exponentially decay. It's like an explosion. All the energy is there at t equal to zero, and then it slowly dies out because there's no more energy. The fact that it's linear means it's like an engine where, in fact, the energy dissipation and the energy production have to balance each other in order to get a constant velocity. Okay? So that then puts a constraint on any model that one might actually want to make of the process, this experiment. Secondly, of course, you see a strong temperature dependence. This is at 5 degrees, that's at 30 degrees. At higher temperatures, you actually see it moving very fast. I'm not going to tell you about why, in fact, the dependence is the way it is, in terms of very strong dependence in temperature, because we have ideas, but I'm not sure about it. But I'll tell you about why you can get a constant, or how you can get a constant velocity, and then from that model, a prediction, a qualitative prediction, not a quantitative one. So here's the model. The model is very simple. I showed you that, in fact, the acrosome can either be negatively twisted with one chirality or positively twisted with another chirality. It's not stable in a straight state, so it's like a switch where I can basically have the switch be stable in its up position or its down position, but it's not stable in between. When calcium binds, so this is the idea, when calcium binds, that straight state in between, which was not normally stable, is stabilized. Okay? So if I basically plot the energy as a function of twist, I go from this double well potential to a single well potential. And there are two time constants. One is the time constant associated with calcium binding, and the second one is once I'm in this kind of a potential, this guy no longer stable, it just falls downhill. And there's a second time scale associated with that, and you can ask which one is faster. For a minute now, forgetting about the time scales, the two different time scales, here is a hypothesis which is consistent with all the structural information. You have stored energy like in a spring. Instead of compression, it's in twist. Calcium is playing a trigger-like role, and dissipation occurs locally. It occurs locally at the place where the calcium binds. And with these, you can quantify these statements and that figure into a little equation, which I won't get into, which essentially characterizes the balance of torques. You get an expression for the velocity. And not only that, you get a qualitative idea, which as soon as I draw this figure, you see immediately, which is that if I chelate calcium, the reaction should stop, and if I unchelate it, the reaction should start. And indeed, here is such an experiment qualitatively, where the reaction starts, you chelate the calcium, and essentially doesn't stop, but slows down, almost stops, and then when you add the calcium back on, you see a transient, and then it starts to grow again. So we are beginning to quantify this. We don't have all the details of how this occurs, but it's consistent with a simple-minded theory. And more than anything else, I think the point to emphasize over here is that there is just one parameter in the theory, and that is essentially the ratio of that energy to that energy. There are no other parameters. So it's a higher-level model than at the individual molecular level, but with parameters which are essentially measurable. In fact, the ratio of these two you can measure using calorimetry. Again, I want to digress and tell you there is a general principle over here, which is how you can essentially propagate fronts of conformation change through crystals. This is known to actually have a deep role in chemotaxis in bacteria. Here is the same thing occurring in long, slender structures. In fact, just last year, there was a paper published in Cell where molecules, a particular class of molecules called spiroplasma, in fact, seem to swim by having the propagation of kinks move along them. Okay, so I've told you about this super specific example of a spring and put it in a broader context. I now want to move up in scale and think about organismal machines, first about motor arrays such as flagella or muscles, and then about hydraulic engines. And in fact, I'll just have a very brief remark to say about motor arrays because I don't really have a whole lot of time to talk about that. And as we go up in scale, we have to start asking about collective aspects. If I have a large number of molecules, just like if I have a single molecule made of a large number of atoms, that molecule has its own mechanical properties. It has an elasticity. It has some resistance to rates of deformation. It has charge, and so on. Similarly, if I look at the next scale, it would have some elastic properties. So now tissue or in a whole organelle, excuse me, whole organism, it would have dynamics and dissipation associated with movements of water through it and in it and outside it. And so we have got to include all these elements in addition to the chemistry associated and the biochemistry associated with how one kind of energy is essentially transduced to mechanical work. On the micro scale, I told you about polymerization engines and muscles. You can think about now arrays of motors, and I'm sorry that you can't see this video because even I can't see it from here. This is essentially a chlamydomonas cell where you see the flagella beating, and the flagella actually don't beat in synchrony, they beat slightly asynchronously. And we've started to ask the question, we haven't actually completed this, we started to ask the question of, in fact, how might you actually think about now a million of these individual dynein motors walking along the microtubules and then figure out how they actually interact with each other, because each one comes on, walks, maybe a few steps, comes off, how do they synchronize? And you have to ask about how the movement of the molecules essentially tries to change the shape, and we know how that happens. It's very similar, but in a dynamic sense, to what I told you happens with two filaments. If I have the two filaments and I have some interaction between them, which is actually dynamic, so that a motor is walking along them, then the filaments will slide relative to each other. But as soon as I clamp one end so that it can't slide, it will start to bend. It could bend in one direction or bend in another direction. So it's the dynamic analog of this interaction that I told you in the context of the spring. So that changes the shape, but once the shape changes, the axoneme, the microtubules, pull on the motors, and when they pull on the motors tend to fall off. So you have essentially a mechanochemistry which is both ways. The shape is influenced by the molecular dynamics of what happens to an individual motor. That changes the macroscopic shape of the flagella. As the macroscopic change of the shape of the flagella changes, that puts stresses on individual motors which then can fall off. Okay? So there is a two-way coupling when we want to think about the collective behavior of motor arrays, both from the molecules to the macroscopic, but also from the macroscopic to the molecules. And so we know, because people have done these beautiful experiments at the single molecule, at the single motor level, you know that there is a strain-dependent mechanochemistry. You can measure the force-velocity curve of an individual motor. And we put that in as an input from experiment, and then we collectively ask, we ask what is the collective behavior and ensemble of motors. Without going into any details, the kinds of questions that one can then try and address is, for example, if I keep the on rate of the motors constant and only varying with the stress due to this mechanochemistry, but I vary the off rate, when I vary the attachment rate, the on rate of the motors, which you can do, and you vary the density of motors, which is much more difficult, but it's possible to think theoretically of that, I can ask, what is the phase space of possibilities? So low density of motors, obviously you don't get oscillations at all because the motors can't flex the axon, you can't flex the microtubules. High enough density, you actually will get oscillations. But interestingly, you don't get oscillations either for very low attachment rates or for very high attachment rates. For low attachment rates, you don't get, because it's obvious there are not motors bound for enough time to essentially generate force. In between, you get oscillations. So this curve above it are oscillations, below it there are no oscillations. For very high attachment rates, we didn't expect this, but in retrospect, it's obvious, because very high attachment rates means it doesn't come off very often. If it doesn't come off very often, you don't have that strain-dependent mechanochemistry, and if you don't have that, things won't fall off, and if they don't fall off, you don't have the ability for it to recover and flex in the other direction. Okay, so that's, again, a way where we sort of parse the problem down into a minimal set of parameters. We work on the continuum level and then try and address this kind of a question. A second question that you can ask is, and this is experimentally very easy to do, is to ask how does the frequency of oscillations depend on the length of the flagella? And we can basically snip the flagella or look at different organisms with different lengths. And here is where molecular information is important, but it's not the only thing, because it has to now move through viscous fluid, and not surprisingly, you find that as the length increases, the frequency decreases in a way which is predictable. In fact, it goes as the 1/4th power of the length. Here is an image of the flagellar beat itself, but I don't want to go into that. Okay. So, having given you a flavor of sort of the collective behavior without having told you any of the details at all, I want to make this notion of using analogies slightly even more crazy by thinking about a macroscopic, completely macroscopic problem, okay? Thinking about moving through water. And I want to focus on the movement of fishes by using a visual analogy, which I will make quantitative mathematically, but then I'll use that to raise questions which we are starting to look at. Again, I'm not going to show you the details of the mathematics at all, but I'll give you a physical feeling. So when a fish moves through water, they move through very differently depending on the kind of fish. So I want now you to assume that I'm thinking about an eel, something which is very long and has movement which is essentially distributed over the entire length. And so the eel essentially flexes from one side to the other, and as it flexes, it pushes water, and it uses that movement of water that it's essentially pushing away to generate thrust and actually move in one direction. And one might imagine that if I designed a fish, an artificial fish, something with engines on it, then I want to do that in some optimal way which minimizes the amount of energy that I actually put into the water. There is no reason to imagine that's the case in biology, but I want to just hold that thought for 10 seconds, because if I were to imagine that were the case, then I can ask an inverse question, which is that if I had something which was not a fish, but just a flat plate, something which is very soft, and I had fluid blowing past it, that's the equivalent of going into a frame running with the fish. And now ask, what happens? Well, I know what happens. In fact, if I basically look at a flag, at low velocities, it doesn't do anything. At high enough velocities, it will start to flutter. And that's a physical problem that we know how to analyze. Well, at least we should know how to analyze, even though it's been around actually for a very long time. It turned out that that wasn't possible to analyze it because of some mathematical difficulties until fairly recently. So here is an experiment, and again, it should play, and it didn't. Here is an experiment of a flag, but it's a two-dimensional flag. A beautiful experiment done at NYU. It's a soap film, which is moving under the influence of gravity, into which you introduce a silk thread. So the soap film is flowing. And as associated, and the force associated with flow, essentially, at some critical value of the flow speed, or equivalently, when the silk thread is long enough, make the silk thread oscillate from side to side, okay? Which you can actually see here. The silk thread starts here and ends here, and then you have vortices which are shed from the rear. And again, without getting into any of these details, for a long time it was thought that the vortices actually were responsible for the frequency of oscillation. Turns out it's not the case, and you can see this visually, because you can see the frequency of oscillations of the vortex shedding is very small compared to the oscillations of the film itself. So completely different time scales, so that's not true. So what's happening? Well, what's happening is the following, without getting into complicated differential equations. What's happening is the following. If I have flow past a flag, this is my hand now, which is hinged, say, right where I am, where my shoulder is, then if I tilt this flag to one side, there is the aerodynamic pressure acting on that, which will essentially want to straighten it. Okay, because I've tilted it, it wants to come back down. But because of inertia, it's not going to stop here, it's going to go to the other side. But if it goes to the other side, exactly the opposite happens, and so you get an oscillation. And that has one frequency, and that frequency is determined by the properties of the fluid and just the mass of the solid, actually the rotational moment of inertia. That has no a priori relation to the other frequency in the system, which was if I switched off the fluid or had a vacuum and I just hit the flag, it will oscillate, and it has now oscillations which have a frequency which depend just on the length of the flag, the material it's made of, and that's it, just like the flagellum problem, okay? A priori, these two frequencies are not the same, but as I tune the velocity of the fluid, there's a critical velocity of the fluid at which these two frequencies become the same. And then I can pump energy from the fluid into the flag. And qualitatively and mathematically, this is not so dissimilar to the idea of a laser, in fact. Okay? So there is a way in which I can pump, and it's not a resonance in the normal sense because I'm essentially driving a DC flow. In normal resonance, you pump the swing, like in a laser, you pump your oscillator with a frequency which is at or very close to the natural frequency of the oscillator, and you get a large amplification here. You're using DC, but you get an AC response. Okay. So you can quantify that, and quantifying that, again, gives you very nice analytical formulae in a limit for the oscillation the velocity of the fluid at which oscillations start in terms of parameters such as the modulus of the material property of the solid, the density of the fluid, the thickness of the flag, and the length of the flag. And it also gives you an expression for the frequency in terms of the material properties of the solid, the density of the solid, and the aspect ratio. And you can check against the experiment. So now, having told you this, I want to turn the question around and ask about a fish. Okay? If I want to try and understand motility, even though I've thought about organismal, told you about organismal motility, the organism is moving in an environment and it has proprioception, it has the ability to actually sense the environment. And so understanding motility, it's not sufficient to understand one molecule or even a collection of molecules. I have to also understand how the organism is sensing its environment. So I have three parts of the question of motility. First part is, given the wave form or given the molecular movements of individual motors, can I predict the shape? Second part is, once I predict the shape, which is changing dynamically, can I predict the movement of the macroscopic body? Because now that's reacting with the environment. If there was no environment, it's not going to get anywhere. And even that's not enough, because there's a third part, which is that the body is not dumb. The body can actually respond to the environment because it has sensory perception, it has mechanoperception, and it can use that in order to essentially control the gait in ways, for example, if to minimize time, for capture, maximize efficiency, or whatever function that you want. So that's a difficult and a very tall challenge to address. And what you see over here are two semi-analytical calculations. So semi-analytical in the sense that we had reduced the problem to an eigenvalue problem and solved it. And when we solve it, we essentially get both the gait and the movement without. So this is not neural. There is no feedback, but we don't prescribe the shape of the of the fish. We only prescribe the musculature and how the forces are along the musculature. And once you prescribe that, you get both the shape of the fish and how fast it moves. And these are two limits, which in fact you know intuitively, correspond to one case where the mass of the fish is very, very large. The density of the fish is very large compared to that of the fluid, in which case the fish sort of is like a whale or like a battleship. It just moves its tail from left, from one side to the other, and the forces from the fluid on the fish are not large enough for it to be essentially perturbed. This is the other case, which is something like a porpoise, because if I have the fish density, or the fish actually density multiplied by an aspect ratio, it turns out, to be small compared to that of the fluid, then once the fish pushes against the fluid pushes back, but with a phase lag. And so what happens is that on average, I move in a straight line, but in fact, I'm oscillating from side to side. And you can actually see this with birds as well. Sometimes they essentially are able to fly very straight, and sometimes their wings are going up and down. The body is essentially reciprocating in a different way. Okay? So you see this kind of behavior in our calculations. Here is an experiment done across the road, in fact, at Harvard and George Lauder's lab, where he's put a fish which has been anesthetized so that the muscular contractions are not happening behind a wake, so that you have vortices which are shedding. And what you find is something very beautiful. The fish sort of comes up. So, sorry, two experiments. One where it was anesthetized, and then you just see the passive flutter, like a flag. Second experiment where it was not anesthetized, the musculature was at work, muscular forces were at work, but you measure activity. And so he finds that, in fact, the fish swims up, for reasons which we don't know, to the place where you have shedding of vortices. And once it actually comes to the place right behind, the musculature, muscular forces shut down. The activity of the muscles essentially shuts down. So it starts to self-synchronize with the environment. Not inconsistent with the idea that I proposed originally, which was somewhat teleological, that perhaps the fish wants to swim so that it's essentially minimizing the amount of energy that it's dumping into the environment. But a lot more work has to go in order to actually understand this feedback process, because fishes have a very beautiful sensory apparatus associated with determining pressure, called the lateral line, as again people over here I'm sure know. We don't understand the details of that, but if you can understand it qualitatively, you could probably put this back in. Okay, so my last example is motivated by the fact that it's good to talk about not just animals, but about plants, because many of us actually live on them. And so this is somehow the revenge of the vegetarian. So I told you about moving through water. I want to now tell you about moving using water. Now, plants and fungi, plants in particular, have all the apparatus required to make molecular movements happen. You have myosin, you have actin, but they don't have muscles, or at least they don't have this spectacular hierarchical structure that we find in us, for example. We don't know why, but one of the reasons could be that plants, in fact, have cell walls. Plant cells have cell walls, and these cell walls have the ability to have the plant cell internal pressure, the turgor, be as large as 10 atmospheres. Okay? In fact, that's what actually keeps your carrot very, very crisp until you let it dry out, and it becomes very difficult to essentially tear it. So in fact, water is providing the stiffness to plants, generically. Okay. So how do plants move? So in fact, it would seem like they can only move water around because they can't have these complicated structures that they can build on large scales, but they can move water around. In fact, they are the most amazing engineers of water on our planet. They can silently move water up a giant sequoia, redwoods, a few hundreds of gallons a day, completely silently, and they do this essentially using evaporation and some very sophisticated plumbing, which allows things not to essentially clog up with bubbles. I want to talk not about slow movements associated with water, but rapid movements. And the Venus flytrap is a great example. And in fact, sort of historically, the first person to conduct a detailed study was actually Darwin himself. He wrote an entire book on insectivorous plants. And his motivation was evolutionary. In fact, the Venus flytrap is actually peculiar only to the Carolinas in this country. And they grow in swampy regions where, in fact, you don't have nitrogen-fixing bacteria. So the plants have a problem, which is how do they get nitrogen into themselves if they don't have these processes associated with nitrogen fixation in the soil. And they've resorted to an evolutionary niche determination, which is basically you just grab it by grabbing animals. Okay, so that was his idea, and I'll show you another example of that. The Venus flytrap is essentially triggered, so you have these leaves which have mechanosensors. They actually have an action potential. They don't have axons, and they don't have sodium and potassium action potentials. They basically have a calcium-based action potential, and it's diffuse because you don't have specialized wires. And it happens fairly quickly. This is essentially the Venus flytrap leaf closing. This is high-speed video, about 100, 150 frames a second. Those dots were painted so that we can essentially look at it carefully, look at the change in geometry. And it happens fairly quickly. But it reopens very, very slowly. And here is a characterization of the shape in terms of the curvature. Again, I won't get into the details. There are two invariants of the curvature for the mathematicians, sort of the mean and the Gauss curvature. Here is the mean curvature at one value. Initially, you trigger it. It changes slowly. Then it drops suddenly. Then it exponentially relaxes to another value. And here is the Gauss curvature, the product of the two curvatures in direction perpendicular to the midrib and parallel to the midrib. And that also jumps. How does it do it? Same question as always. In every one of these systems, how does this work? And experimentally, you can actually show that something very nice is happening, namely the length of the cells in the transverse direction to the midrib is changing enormously. These arrows determine how much the length has changed, and it's changing very little in the transverse direction. That's consistent with surgery. Okay, what's the surgery that you do? You cut the leaf in this direction and see what happens to it, cut a strip of it. You cut it in this direction and see what happens. If you cut it in this direction, as you've seen showing a cartoon over here, but that's the real thing, in fact, the leaf springs even further to close, while if you cut it parallel to the leaf retracts. So that's consistent with this idea that there's very little happening in this direction, a lot happening in that direction. So what's the physics? Physics is very, very easy to understand. And I want now you to think of what happens when I put a paperback in the bathroom. If I put a paperback in the bathroom, typically the paperback has a cover, which is actually coated with plastic, and paper is cellulose, which is very hygroscopic and absorbs water enormously. So if I wait for a while, then because of the moisture in the bathroom, paper absorbs water from the side where it can absorb it. And in fact, the paperback cover curls. Okay? And that curling is occurring because you have a differential amount of water on one side compared to the other. That happens very slowly. If, in fact, you did the same experiment, which you should try with your children, with something which was originally curved, and now I try to push water across it, it turns out that there is a critical curvature at which, critical amount of curvature in two directions, at which, instead of smoothly changing its conformation, it rapidly changes its conformation. That's what's happening for the Venus flytrap. Okay? So the plant essentially mechanosensory triggers. Allow water to move in the transverse direction and cause this instability consistent with this geometrical idea. You can quantify it. I don't want to get into any of the details. But one nice prediction that comes out, which is essentially, again, parameter-free completely, it's a purely geometric prediction, is that the larger the leaf, the faster it will snap. And the larger the leaf, the more time you'd have to wait before it snaps. And that comes out directly from a geometrical picture, which you can then quantify. And here is the data. The velocity is increasing with the size appropriately characterized with this dimensionless parameter, which includes the size of the leaf, the natural curvature of the leaf, and the thickness of the leaf. And the delay also increases with this parameter. Well, that's nice because, again, you have the ability to understand something which looks incredibly complicated. This plant has water moving. You have cells which change shape. That essentially changes the stress, and that change in stress causes movement. But it seems like you can capture some aspects of it using a fairly simple model. You can also get the time scale. And the time scale is associated with how quickly or how slowly, I should emphasize this, how quickly or how slowly water moves through tissue. And, again, this is something which is a very general idea. It appears everywhere. At the level of an individual cell when it's moving, at the level of tissue, at the level of not just plant tissue, animal tissue, but also plant tissue. How does water move across large scales? And again, a molecular picture is not sufficient because you have to ask the question of what happens to the whole thing collectively. And the picture that one should have is, for example, if I have a porous network like tissue, and if I introduce water in it, then at small times, the water will essentially try and push the tissue out. And then only at large times will the water itself move. So it turns out that that mode is actually diffusive. But it's not diffusion of concentration. It's not diffusion of molecules. It's diffusion of stress or diffusion of pressure. And that allows us to ask a question with which I will close. Is there a method to any of this madness in the context of movements? Okay, so I want to show you four movies. Three of them were essentially taken from this fantastic DVD that David Attenborough made about 15 years ago called The Private Life of Plants. This is something that we worked on. Fast movement over here. Another kind of fast movement associated with how essentially seed pods explode. A different kind of fast movement which is peculiarly seen in South Asia associated with a sensitive plant where, in fact, leaves can essentially close. This is real time. That's, of course, a high-speed video. And my favorite, where instead of a fungus being eaten by a worm, the worm is eaten by the fungus. And the best way for me to essentially show you this is to play the audio. You can't hear that. So let's see. Can you hear this? Can anybody hear this? No. Okay. Well, let me just describe it. So this is a worm moving through soil. The fungus essentially makes little stomata-like structures, which are three cells in size, and it exudes a pheromone, which the worm likes. So the worm essentially moves through it. Okay. And again, there is a calcium-dependent mechanism where calcium moves into the cell, increase in concentration pulls water in, and there is an instability by which this essentially explodes like an airbag, constricting the worm. Okay. Very rapid movements on the small scale can occur because you can move water very easily on small scales. On the large scale, you can move water in one direction easily, but not in another. Here, again, you have movements driven by water, except now it's driven by drying. The outside is drying, the inside is not. Okay? And then you touch it and the same thing happens. So is there a mad method to all this? And I want to close by essentially suggesting, yes, there is. It's because, in fact, there's a very simple question that the plants and the fungi are trying to solve. The question is that of rapid movement, whether it's for seed dispersal or capture or whatever. That's the question. The constraints are that you have cell walls, so you can't essentially build large structures like muscles, but you can have very high pressures of water inside. And you can move the water around, and of course you're moving the water around through some soft tissue. The solution is to have small-scale rapid movements, like in the carnivorous fungus that I showed you, and other such situations, or you can have large-scale rapid movements. But the physics of these two is very different, because on the large scale you have to move large objects, and small scale you move small objects. And the design principle that we propose is essentially that when you want to switch from this kind of a solution for small scales to large scales, you have to change the geometry. You've got to make something very thin and very long. And in order to check that, here is a plot, in fact, of the time scale of movement. And here is the smallest dimension of the organelle that's essentially being moved. These are slow movements, very long time scales, it's a log-log plot. These are rapid movements. They occur for small organisms very easily, but if I want rapid movements, I want to come down here, small times, and large scales. Here is a line that I have to cross, and that line is essentially crossed by changing the design. I make thin leaves or long objects. And of course, there's another line over here, and that line is the speed of sound. The time scale is proportional to the length scale divided by velocity, and nothing's on the right side of it, obviously. Okay. So what this suggests is that there is, even though we have all these molecular constraints from the point of view of evolution, there are only so many solutions which are possible, and all those have been discovered. And all those solutions are constrained by physics. Okay? So that's it. So I want to stop by basically telling you, I mean, you have the ability to look at motility at multiple scales, and at each scale you have a class of questions, some of which actually allow you to move back and forth, some of which are just perfectly reasonable to ask at that particular scale. Zubin already said, you know, some of these are completely crazy questions. We have been driven primarily by curiosity more than anything else, and a good way to end would be, in fact, to quote a favorite of mine, the first lexicographer, in fact, Samuel Johnson, who said, "The scientist who is not content with superficial views harasses himself with fruitless curiosity, and still, as he inquires more, perceives only that he knows less." Thank you very much.
Thank you for a very delightful lecture. Questions? The microphone. Comments? Well, I'll thank Dr. Mahadevan, and there's a reception outside if anyone wants to speak to him personally. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks a lot.